Writer's Gym Podcast. Build creative confidence and grow your writing life with Rachel Knightley and Emily Incan. Welcome to the Writer's Gym Podcast. And today we're going to be talking about editing. I think this is an area that new writers find especially difficult, but it is, of course, a vital part of the process. Mm-hmm. Now, no strangers to the editing process are Rachel Knightley and Emily Inkpen.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. And Emily, can we start by thinking about what we're trying to achieve when we edit, please?
I think the best way of saying this, it's been said before by Neil Gaiman, which is the second draft is for making it look like we knew what we were doing from the start. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly right. You know, first draft is all about just getting the words down a lot of the time. And then when we edit, we finesse and we make sense of it almost. We step back and say, what do we have here? Ah, it's a thing. What kind of thing is it? It's that kind of thing. Is that clear from the start? Let's find out. And we dive in again from the start. And yes.
So lots of iterations, and we'll talk about them as we go through this podcast. Mm-hmm. Now, Rachel, I've heard you use the charming term vomit draft.
It is charming, isn't it?
to mean the first version of a piece of writing. Are there ever instances where your vomit draft is fit for consumption by your readers? Ooh,
that is an extended metaphor. Okay.
It's a terrible way of putting it, wasn't
but,
it?
But thank you for that image. I didn't
who
think I was going
to
be outgrossed.
Who consume your vomit, though,
who consumes your vomit, Rachel? No one's ever said that to me before.
I'll get my coat.
What that term is so useful for, and I didn't invent it, it's done the rounds for a long time, but it's one that I wish I'd known earlier, because it explains that writing in the first place, get it out, see what it is that you're trying to say, mm-hmm. and preferably get to the end of it so you're clear about what you're trying to say. That makes your editing faster, better, more truthful. Mm-hmm. The reason I wish I'd known that earlier is that I had an editing addiction. I thought that you could work on the first chapter you'd written of a novel that didn't exist yet and make that chapter as good as you possibly could before you move on to chapter two, mm-hmm. which is why I didn't finish that, and why a lot of people don't finish things and think, I haven't got the confidence in this, it's not perfect yet, so I won't move on. And the best thing about doing this as a job is you know that perfect was never on the menu.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about find out what you're trying to say and move it forward. And that's the difference between writing and editing. And editing, I would include rewriting in editing, is that you're moving it closer to itself every time.
Mm. Yeah.
That's a really nice thought, I think, that whatever, however many iterations, it is always progress. It's always moving towards something that is going to be better than the time before.
Yeah, absolutely. And clearer in its intent.
Mm.
And
yes.
Purpose.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now, a fear that a lot of listeners may have, and especially, again, if they're new to the process of editing, is this. How do you identify what is great about your story and make sure that you don't lose that in the process of editing?
A very good editor said to me recently, I love your script. Now you have to not mess it up.
Mm. Well, no pressure there then.
Yeah, Chris Gregory, have you heard of him?
And of a radio drama we were.
It might be that. And it was such a beautiful way of putting it, because I'm summarising. Obviously, this was bigger discussions. But in changing or improving technical things, it's so important to not lose the spirit of the creature, of what this thing is. Mm-hmm. And that was something I really valued, because as editorial comment, it showed you believed in what I was doing. Mm-hmm. That didn't mean there wasn't a lot more I needed to do, but the essence of it was there. And that's always enormously encouraging and helpful. And it makes you realise that the creative risks that you take are there for a reason. Obviously, this goes back to save your drafts, open a new draft, take the risks and have something for each of them that you can revert to if you want to. Yep. But it does allow you that, that springboard, that freedom.
Mm.
Yes, the difference between feeding and cutting, I think.
Yeah.
Is feeding the good bits, cutting the extraneous bits. But the good bits are the bits that are making it its thing.
It's like gardening, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. Weeding and allowing other things, more space, more soil to grow.
More sunlight.
Yeah. And or pruning, perhaps, because the act of pruning is, in effect, destroying something so that the rest of it is stronger, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, you're making me realise that we're in my living room. I did realise that. And we have one plant where I could cut the bits that are growing out of the flower pot off, and the bits that are growing in the right direction would have the right amount of light and everything. But I don't prune them because I feel a bit sad doing that. I don't want to cut bits off. But my gardener would be very happy for me to do that, because then everything else would grow literally up and make space for it. Mm. So maybe gardening and editing have got things to teach me together that I hadn't noticed.
What would you call that, editing a plant?
I need to edit my plant, Emily. I can see it from here, and I do need to edit it. Yeah.
Welcome to the Gardener's World podcast. So Emily, I know a lot of your writing comes from characters and their relationships. So when you start to edit, I mean, presumably there is something in your initial draft.
Yep.
There is a magic, there is a essence of characters there.
I hope so.
Well, yeah. And but again, we're back to that danger of editing potentially for the sake of editing them.
Yeah.
How do you decide what
is too much editing and what is not? I mean, I guess one of the things that I would say is don't lose the character stuff. Some people hear very draconian rules about writing and think that if it's not feeding the plot, if every sentence isn't feeding the plot, if every sentence isn't working hard on the action and driving the structure where you are right now, then cut it. And what the danger of following that rule is that you lose the stuff that makes the reader care about whether or not they get to the end of the plot, whether or not they get through the tense moments. So I think it's very important to not forget your characters. And one of the things that I see, like, people editing out is, okay, so there's a film term, shot, reaction, shot.
Mm.
And you have to show the reaction. If something big has happened, it needs to land, and you need to see it land for it to be real. And the landing is where the characters come in. You know, big explosion has happened. If the character just gets up and runs off, it hasn't really happened. The character needs to react to the explosion and needs to acknowledge the thing that's just happened. Needs to say, I am now terrified. Like, not say I am now terrified, but, you know, you need to reflect that in your words. Like, the intent behind, you know, what they feel needs to be conveyed. This thing has just happened. This is my reaction to it. Now I can run off and carry on and carry the story. But the reader is then with them in that moment, in that feeling. And I think that, yes, in that respect, checking in with the character after a big event is feeding the plot, is carrying the narrative forward. But some people think, well, we don't need that. That interrupts the pace. And it's like, no, it reinforces what's happened.
Well, the stakes of it.
Exactly.
You know, we often talk about stakes, don't we? What what this, you know, this sequence of events will mean to a character.
Yeah.
So a high stakes event is generally more dramatic for that character.
Yeah.
Has more impact on.
And I don't mean getting touchy feely about this. I don't mean the character being all emotional and getting in touch with their feelings, because a lot of characters don't have any kind of emotional intelligence. But reporting the truth of that character after the event. That is what I'm getting at here.
Yeah.
It's the observations that matter to that character. A big explosion has happened. What do they notice in that moment? Do they notice the fear on people's faces? Do they notice the grief of people? Is that disturbing to them? Is that not? Are they running away because they're scared, or are they running away because they don't know how to deal with the people and the other people's reactions to what's happening? You know, it's that stuff. they don't necessarily have to know. We don't have to sort it out. We don't need a psychological treatise on what they, you know, what their reaction here. We just need something.
And because it's not necessarily pure plot, it may be tempting to
cut it out,
edit that out.
Exactly. But it's incredibly important, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll come back to more of the nuance of editing as this podcast goes on. But Rachel, I want to come to you now and think about just practicalities. So how do you commence your first edit when you've done your vomit draft? What's the next stage? And I'm thinking of iterations here. What's the first task?
Yeah, this always feels very different to different people. I think what one person calls their first draft, another might sort of call their third up to a point, because it's where do you get to a point where you feel like you've got the whole thing, beginning, middle, end, in that order. For Twisted Branches, for my recent short story cycle, it was quite an interesting one because I have dyspraxia and coordination, which can include numbers and chronology, is not my idea of fun. And I was dealing with five generations in one family house and and their different perspectives on the same events. So in a way, I'd set myself my self-designed nightmare. One of the things that I do in that situation where something might be a bit complicated or you could do with some reassurance as you move into editing it, is I'd have my post-it notes that had the years that the things happened, that had the titles of the stories. So I had my cheat sheet, if you like. I don't approve of the word cheat. It's so easy to just honour our own imposter syndrome rather than just get on with it. But that was what I thought of it as. It was a cheat sheet. And it meant that I felt free to experiment with the characters, take space and time for their reactions, like you said, Emily, that if there is an event that happens, making sure that we are honouring that, that we are seeing the repercussions and sometimes the foreshadowing and the parallels that happen in the different generations. And it meant that I was still able to take my risks and make my changes, but still have a sort of aerial view of it, is something I find helpful, that I could go back to my timeline and main points. I'm not a massive planner. I needed to know how old everybody was in every given time to make sure it literally made sense. But beyond that, really, I don't have fun in over planning. I want to go into the character's head and go for a walk as authentically as I can and experience whatever I experience. And yes, I know that certain things need to happen in order for all the other stories to make sense, but for me, that's when you start editing and taking greater risks and having more fun, is when you know the skeleton is there. Then you can start filling in that unique body.
So in a sense then, that process of editing begins with the plan, the plot, the chronology, the timeline, the background information about characters, and I guess you're using all of that as a gauge against which you edit?
Yes, because then you can come back to the beginning and go, okay, this little detail that looks like nothing is going to really be important later on. So how do I make sure it's there, but it doesn't go, look, look, I'm an important detail, here I am, so that people can think, oh, jolly good, some nice scenery, on we go. And it allows you to sew the bits together in a gentle way so that it's a patchwork quilt rather than a lumpier creature, I suppose. But it is all smooth. It does lead from one thing to another.
Emily, you're the author of a hugely successful audio drama podcast. And I want to think a little bit about the editing process for drama. Can you tell us a bit about your first edit of a script, please?
This is a fun question. Okay. So the first edit of a script, I mean, I guess I plan a bit more in scripts than I do when I'm writing the novel, because you have to have a destination in mind for an episode. And if you're writing episodically, you have to kind of know what's happening in each episode or what beats you have to hit before the next episode and before the next episode. And I find that I have to be more aware of what each scene is doing. So the first sort of edit pass is audio prompts. So I know what's going on, does the audience? So for me, it's all about sort of making sure the script works as audio. Who's in the scene? Does the audience know they're there? You know, I'll go back to the previous episode and I'll check that I've picked up all of the threads from that episode. And I check directions and make sure that my directions are all audio and not visual, and make sure that I've got the information that the actors are going to need in there. Are the scenes working in the order that I've placed them in?
Mm.
That's a good one. Because sometimes the threads will, you know, the threads are all being picked up in the episode, but are they being picked up in the right order for the pacing of the episode?
Mm.
And sometimes you can, just by switching something around, you start with more of a bang, or you end with more of a bang, you know, like it changes things, but you've still achieved all of the things that you need to achieve within the episode itself. It's sort of a process of taking a step back and looking at the puzzle and saying, okay, yes, this all fits, this all works, but is it working the best way that it can?
Mm.
And if I take this piece out and this piece in there, does it actually go together better? That's taking a very loose idea of the puzzle, because puzzles really egg. But
yeah.
I so agree with that. Challenging the preconceptions you don't know you have in editing, that you think something has to look a certain way, and then by doing what you're describing, you can find the whole thing lifts.
Yeah.
Mm.
And that actually being precious about the order you've written it in initially, it doesn't help.
Mm.
Because it can be as simple as saying, okay, no, this has to happen first. Or maybe even, this character needs to lead this scene,
yes,
as opposed to another character.
Mm.
We need to see it from their point of view, not the other way. And things like that can just make it hit home better. It's basically just making it better, isn't it, really, editing?
Mm.
It's just, okay, this is what I've got. This is where I need to go. It's the launch pad of what I've got. Is it as good as it can be? Can it be doing things better?
Yeah. The thing that I always have in my mind is it as itself as it can be?
Yeah.
Mm.
If there's anything that's a little bit boggy or unclear, you know, some people use images of getting the statue more detailed from the lump of clay to gradually the eventual statue. It's kind of that. There's a load of metaphors for it, but is it as itself as it can be?
Mm-hmm.
That's my job when I'm in editing mode.
Yes.
And I guess, you know, if that's going to be one of your criteria, and probably a main criteria, you need as a writer to understand what that essence is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is that figure in the stone that you're going to make the statue of?
So it absolutely begins with you. And I think this was, ironically, the reason I did my coaching qualification was in order to better help the writers that I was already working with, because to do that, you have to do it in your life as well.
Mm.
You've got to be clear in your head about what you actually want to say. You're not helping yourself if you avoid those questions.
Mm-hmm.
If you go, I can't possibly look at this memory, or I can't possibly go to that place in my imagination, you're cutting off your material. And although the editing process is about making the material you've already got better, it's interesting to notice when we're editing too soon in our heads as well as on the page.
Mm.
And that can be enormously relevant.
Yeah. Mm,
indeed. Emily, we've heard about that process of editing an audio drama script. The one thing I would say about audio drama is there's a second bite of the cherry, isn't there? Once you've recorded, there is then post-production.
Yes.
where you can do editing in it. And that, you know, would very much be the case in film, and on the stage, actually, when you've done a, you know, first run through with actors, maybe things become more apparent. And maybe that's part of the process of using alpha and beta readers for a prose writer.
Well, I mean, like, especially on the stage, you bring up the stage thing. A director will sit in the audience for all of the performances and take notes,
yeah,
and then give notes to the actors after every performance.
Mm.
You know, it's normal for that to happen, in my experience anyway. And there is always like a, when you arrive to do the warm-ups and everything before this, you know, the show begins, the director is like, any notes? Yes. This is what happened last time, you know, maybe a bit quicker on that line. Let's up the energy here. And, you know, and just giving feedback on that. And the feedback loop is continuous respect. It's just constantly keeping it good and, you know, and polished.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we'll come back to that shortly. But Rachel, I want to ask you about structural edits. We've talked about this kind of structure, this yardstick that you have against which you write you use as a point of reference for what you're doing and what you're editing. Do you have a process for settling on that chronology and structure of a story? And do you sometimes find yourself changing that while you're editing?
I think the most important thing about an editing process is that nothing is sacred.
Mm.
I don't think if you're too rigid about what you're seeing, then you're really seeing it clearly enough.
Mm.
If something isn't working, it's much more likely to be because of how rigid you are being about something mm-hmm. that you at some level know isn't working than because you've been too experimental about it. I suppose the true answer to that question is it is different every time because it has to be. There are certain stories as writers that we, or as humans, that we are revisiting again and again and again. They're always going to be different, but there are going to be ingredients that it's completely all right to go back to. Yes. And it is about finding out what you're trying to say with it, I think.
Mm.
Mm.
So, Emily, from what Rachel said there, some of her techniques, are there techniques that you use it when you're editing that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, so basically at the end of writing, I get to the end of the story and I take a step back and I sort of ask myself, okay, what do I have here? Is it a book? How does this work? And because I'm not much of a planner, but I'm not a pantser either. I'm somewhere in the middle. But what I end up doing is I get the chapters of the book and I put them all into a spreadsheet. I have multiple perspectives in my books normally, so I line them up so by character. And then I list their chapters underneath. And then I heat map them. So green is for sort of low energy chapters. Orange is for, you know, tension, or yellow, and then orange and then red, depending on how varied the energy levels are in the book. Mm. And then I can see very clearly how the energy flows throughout the book. Normally what you want is for the book to start off relatively chill and then ramp up in tension to the end. Now, it can be that it starts red and then goes down to green and then ramps up. So that can happen. But generally speaking, we start green and we ramp. And then you can see by colour, very simple colour chart, is my book doing that?
Mm.
That's your idea of not being much of a planner?
Yeah. No, this happens retrospectively. So it doesn't happen in advance.
But presumably, having looked at that, you might make some changes, though.
Normally, actually, no. So far, it's just been out of interest.
Yeah.
It probably should be. Yeah.
My mum would understand that. She loves spreadsheets, too.
Mm.
And I like the idea, but I think I find the methodology difficult for other reasons. But I see it.
See, I have a spreadsheet that is haphazard at best. Half the information is just not even there. Every now and again, if I need to refer to something in the story, I will just check the spreadsheet in case on the off chance I noted something down of use, and then I'll be like, no, I didn't do that. So then I've got to go and find it in the book instead. And generally speaking, I know where it is, so it's not too much of a hassle. But yeah, I remember Chris talking about my sort of world, my audio drama, and Chris was saying, yes, but you know, what we need is to share the notes and all of this information that you've clearly got. And I'm like, it's in my head.
It's a shocking and horrifying moment.
Yes, Chris almost had a heart attack, I think, when that happened.
See, for me, if left completely to my own devices, I'm in the Terry Pratchett school. The first draft is you telling yourself the story. I tell myself the story on the page.
Mm-hmm.
I then went back in the case of Twisted Branches and did my little post-it notes because I knew I needed to know what bloody year things were happening in.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was only because I needed to rather than I wanted to. And after that, editing is about finding the people and getting the people to do the things that they would do, reacting to each other, making the conflicts grow out of who they are.
Mm.
But yeah. I don't, I guess like you in a way, I don't see myself as a planner.
Mm.
But then as you start to say it back to yourself and you realise how much is going on subconsciously in that process and then you revisit it afterwards, then yeah, that makes sense.
I guess the first draft is not necessarily planned. The second draft is applying a retrospective plan.
Yeah.
Because you now know, by the end of the first draft, you know what it is.
And as Neil Gaiman said,
second draft is for... Yeah, making it look like you knew what you were doing from the start. Exactly, yeah.
Which is a great quote, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, another quote that we often hear in connection with editing is this thing, killing your darlings, which sounds very brutal. So can we try and give a definition of what killing your darlings is and when we should do it?
The story I tell when I'm introducing people to this involves me knowing a particular sentence was absolutely gorgeous and I was so proud of it and it was absolutely right for the scene and the music and the moment, but the scene wasn't really working. And it was only when I even started to consider I might take that line out and the instinctive no around that thought that I first remember experiencing what this is, which is style over substance. If we get too attached to any line or scene or image or anything at all, then we're trying to build our reality around that rather than using it to be part of the reality. So it starts fighting the reality. And those are the things that have to go. And the more beautiful they are and the harder you've worked on them and how musical or clever or what have you, the more likely it is you might want to try that scene without that line slash paragraph slash whatever it is, because it might just leap up and go, wow, it works now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like it's the difference between being a slave to it and being sort of in control of it. If you love it so much that you can't get rid of it and then you're trying,
then the tail's wagging the dog.
Exactly. You've got to. And I with killing your darlings, I definitely feel like your darlings are a stepping stone to more darlings. And the darlings that you have right now stop being darlings when they're no longer of use and when they're no longer structurally important. Nothing is a darling that is abusive. Yeah. And if it is ruling you and preventing you from doing what's right,
yeah,
then it is not a darling anymore.
And the abusive relationship comparison actually works incredibly well, because when you're in an abusive relationship with someone, quite often what you're doing is making all the excuses in the world for their behaviour.
Yes.
Trying to understand, getting other people to understand, know how really great they are.
Yeah.
When actually they're holding back everything else about your life.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what
we're not suggesting you kill them, by the way. We're just suggesting you don't go out with them. And that works too, because I don't kill those lines. I put them in a different word folder.
Yes.
Away from the book or whatever it happens to be.
And stop being in their thrall, I guess, would be the
absolutely
key thing.
Yeah.
You can put them in another box.
Again, we're not suggesting actually killing people.
We're not?
No.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
No, remember Chris said we weren't supposed to say that.
Yeah, that's true. Different podcast. Okay.
Yeah, different podcast. Right,
yeah.
I feel like I'm in a different podcast. I want to
this
go...
This is about editing, right?
This is about editing.
Okay, right. Sure.
It's editing reality.
So there's so many different ways to describe editing.
Gardening, murder. You're getting so much value.
And now I'm frightened. So a bit more about editing. I mean, there are some writers out there who do not feel they need to edit. They feel that they can, you know, have a first draft that goes straight to print. Can you tell?
If they're paying for it themselves. Yes.
The self-published, yes.
No, yeah. Not just the self-published. Like, there is a thing in publishing where a writer is too big to edit.
Yeah, I'm afraid money does talk. So, yes, at that end of the spectrum, totally seen it happen. But before we solve the world's problems over there, a great place to start solving these problems, is with our own work. And this is where getting other readers and being really specific on the feedback that you ask for, which is what we went into in the last episode, becomes so important if you want it to be as itself as it can be, rather than just thinking and feeling like you've done the job but never finding out how much stronger it could have been if you'd gone into a cooperative relationship with people.
Yeah. Sure.
It's such a shame to waste that opportunity, because I don't know about everybody else, but I'm here to be the best writer I can be. I want my work to be challenged. I want my work to grow. I want my own sense of what I can do to grow, because the best thing for feeling sad, said Merlin, is to learn something. You know, T.H. White, it never stops being fun. It's not like an experienced writer is the opposite side of the coin to an inexperienced writer. We learn every day.
Mm.
And I think that the day someone says they don't have to edit me anymore is probably going to be incredibly sad. I think.
We don't have to read them anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I just know there's always work to be done.
Yeah. Because you never see the possibilities unless you look for them.
Exactly.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, we're coming towards the end of our discussion. But again, another question I think that a lot of inexperienced writers, stroke editors might ask is, how do you know when it's finished? How do you know when you've edited it to the point that it's as good as it's going to be?
Do we have to use the word know as if we ever know?
Well, there is the term, isn't there, that, you know, work of art is never finished, it's abandoned.
Yeah. There is also the line from Anthem by Leonard Cohen, there is a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in.
Mm.
There is no point where whatever you understand as God descends on whatever you understand as a cloud and says, okay, Rachel, done. But there is a point where you have done everything that you can reasonably do. And if you continued faffing, then that's exactly what it would be. It would be faffing.
Mm-hmm.
And you go on to the next thing. I don't have a definitive answer for when that moment is, but what I would offer is a what if.
Mm.
And this, I'm finding this very helpful in my first novel now, and I think that I found it very useful in both my short story collections, and probably when I started on anthologies, when I started on individual stories, even more useful, is what if not everything you're capable of doing needs to be in this book? What if you've got another 10 books around the corner?
Mm-hmm.
What if that was true and you even managed to pack in everything you're capable of into the first book? You're going to be going, damn.
Yeah. How do I follow that?
The second one's going to be really tricky, isn't it?
Yeah. That's like, you can see that sometimes in when you've got a standalone book and then because the standalone book has done really well, the publisher asks for a sequel. You can tell sometimes when there was never intended to be a sequel.
Mm.
And normally then the sequel is pretty weak. And then maybe book three is stronger, because at that point they know there's going to be a book three. So there's lead in to that.
Mm.
But you can kind of tell. And I always think that's a bit of a shame, because people would have read book one and loved it, and then we'll get to this book two that was never really meant to be, and we'll then drop off and be like, well, that was disappointing. Yeah, for me, I like the Empire Strikes Back syndrome. Middle one's the best. That's what you want. You want, like, the first one to hook people enough that they get to the middle one, and the middle one is fantastic, and then they definitely stay for the third. And the third one is also a pretty strong ending, but you want the middle one to be, like, smash it out of the park, I think.
Absolutely.
That's the best thing.
Yeah. I mean, is there a definition of knowing when to stop? That if I keep editing at this point, I'm going to break something?
Definition, no. Reality, yes.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
I don't ever want to make anybody think that there is a right moment to do that. I think asking yourself the question, has that moment come, keeps you in the driving seat.
Mm. And Emily, I guess in the world of audio drama, there is often, and I guess this is true of all scripted media and any book that is being written to order, I suppose, is that the deadline is probably the point at which you've got to stop. Fact that we are going into the studio with some actual
actors,
living, breathing actors, probably suggests we need to stop at that point.
Exactly, yes. There is a definite necessary stop point there.
And there is in prose too. The thing I hated hearing the most is, we can move the deadline if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
I hate those words, because the thing is, when you know there's a deadline, you can get over the overthinking, perfectionism, procrastination, which is categorically the same thing.
Yeah.
Mm.
And you can bring it into the world, which is the goal.
Yeah.
And this probably explains one of your catchphrases, Rachel, which is
give me a deadline, Chris.
Yes.
So, yes, I've heard that once or twice, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. A day.
I have projects. I say to people, like, somebody's given me a project recently, and I say, when's it due? Oh, not yet. Oh. Don't worry, take your time.
Oh, I hate
that. And then they come back to me and say, well, the person's asking for it now. How are you getting on?
With every cell in my body, I hate people not being responsible for when they want you to give them things. Because it comes back to what we were saying about feedback. The stronger the objective is, the stronger somebody has a chance of delivering it to you.
Yes. Mm.
And if you don't know, at least say something that you want, and then you might just get it.
Mm. Mm. Well, a theme that we often come back to in this podcast is best and worst advice on whatever topic we're discussing. So can we have, Emily, you can start, your best or worst advice on editing?
Oh, well, it's pretty standard stuff, really. The best is write fast, edit slow. And I love editing. Actually, I'm a total editing weirdo. Writing things for the first time is always quite arduous for me. And then when I get into editing, it's like, okay, this is fun. I've got it there. I'm no longer as anxious. The worst advice, edit as you go and aim to produce a clean draft, because you can spend all the time in the world going back over at chapter one and you'll never finish it. You will never finish it at that rate.
Because you'll never be looking at the thing as a whole,
will
you?
No, you'll be looking at it. Is this one step perfection? Is this next step perfection? Ultimately, yeah, it's never going to be perfection. Nothing's going to be perfection.
And you're going to miss all those structural things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That Leonard Cohen quote from earlier, which I guess is the best editing advice, there is a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in. That comes from an idea from Jewish thinking that humans can't do perfect. Perfect is what God, if you want to understand God as a being, or you want to understand God as an objective idea, give that to God. You never had perfect on the menu. It's about being authentic, and you can't be authentic if you're trying to be perfect. So read it, see what's on the page, and you'll be able to improve what's there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not about trying to perfectionize everything, or all you'll do is take longer and longer and longer. And the longer we take, the more emotionally involved we get and put more pressure on ourselves. There's good emotional involvement, and then there's realising it's 10, 20, 30 years later and you're still saying, one day this will be perfect, rather than, I want to get this in the world.
Yeah.
And get on with the next one.
Exactly, yeah. Mm. I know people who have been painting over the same first draft, the same book for 10 years.
Mm.
And
you're just stuck in this sort of endless loop, aren't you?
Yeah.
And for the record, I know several examples where after 10 years something got published and lived happily ever after. And I'm planning to be one of them, but it's not what you go in aiming for.
Mm.
And if you're willing to challenge yourself to at least get it out there, then the editing you do will be more meaningful and that beautiful thing a bit faster.
Mm.
Fantastic. Well, we always try to end these podcasts with a task, a challenge, an exercise. Mm. Rachel, what have you got for us this week?
I've got my favourite game, Excuses Bingo.
Mm.
You will need a blank sheet of paper, a pen, and a sense of humour about yourself, writing, and everything else. Draw a massive great noughts and crosses board, maybe 6 lines down, 6 lines across, squares or rectangles big enough that you can get a phrase in there. And then you listen to what your brain comes out with. Examples from my brain can include, so-and-so would hate this. I'm supposed to be this kind of writer, not that kind of writer.
Mm-hmm.
So-and-so would do this so much better than me.
Mm-hmm.
Anything your brain gives you like that, put it in one of those squares or rectangles. Because here's the thing, it'll sound perfectly logical when your brain is saying it to you. However, all of those barks, to use video games, all of them are designed with one goal and one goal only, which is to stop you writing the thing.
Yeah. Mm.
And when you get them all where you can see them, that's when you start playing bingo.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow, when your brain says exactly the same thing, you can go, oh, I remember this, tick. And if it's got a new one, you go, great, I'll add you to my chart. And you see them every day. And the more ticks they get, the more you can realise that's just the obstacle in this level of the game. The objective remains the same. And I'm going to keep going for it, which is to keep writing it, keep editing it, keep improving it so that it gets into the world. There is a part B, which I call bird spotting, which involves this. Just like I'm looking out of the window right now and I might see a sparrow go past and I think sparrow, or a blue tit go past and I think blue tit. I don't judge myself. I don't judge the blue tit or sparrow. I just see a thing and I say the thing. If you want to write down the ones that you hear in a list and the times of day that you hear them, this works with intrusive thoughts, this works with anxiety of any kind, this also can work with depression. I'm not saying it makes it go away, but my God, it allows you to see what's going on and it allows you into a better relationship with it, I think. You can see the patterns and you can see that they're trying to help you, but you can say to those thoughts, I know you're trying to help me, thank you, I'm listening. I'm not desperately trying to push you away, I'm listening, and now I'm going to give you a comfortable seat on the edge of my desk while I get on with writing.
Excellent. Well, it's a game of bingo. You don't want to be winning, really. You don't want that full house, do you?
I think reframe what winning looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Winning is getting the book finished.
Mm. Yeah.
And also, there's nothing to do with the bingo.
There is a certain amount of winning of being able to put those things down in a bingo grid in the first place. Self-awareness. Yeah. In itself is a win.
That in itself is it, bingo.
Yeah.
Is when I quoted Ariel Fisher, the say the thing advice.
Yeah.
It's about your mental state as well, that you don't get to divorce the writer from the writing.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean everything you're doing is autobiographical. It doesn't mean that you're limited by that, but you are the person with the pen in the hand, literally or otherwise. Mm-hmm. And the more you understand your own thinking, the more you make peace with your own thinking, the more you realise we've all got the same software going on, it's okay, the more you can do it anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
Well, what a great note to end on. Listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this little trot through the world of editing and self-awareness bingo. As always, Rachel Knightley, Emily Penn, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Writer's Gym podcast with Rachel Knightley, Emily Inkpen, and me, Chris Gregory. If you'd like to learn more about Rachel and the Writer's Gym, please go to rachelknightley.com. To find out more about Emily, please go to emilyinkpen.com. And for Chris, go to alternativestories.com. We'll print all these links and more in the show notes for this podcast. The Writer's Gym podcast is an Alternative Stories 2024 production for The Writer's Gym. Production, sound design and editing were by me, Chris Gregory.